Welcome to the Enabled Disabled Podcast. I'm your host, Gustavo Serafini. I was born with a rare physical disability called PFFD. My journey has been about self-acceptance, persistence, and adaptation. On the show, we'll explore how people experience disability, how the stories we tell ourselves can both enable and disable, how vulnerability is the foundation for strength, and why people with disabilities can contribute more than we imagine. I hope that leaders, companies, clinicians, families, and friends will better understand our capacity to contribute to the world and help enable us to improve it. Austin Stamm is an occupational therapist, filmmaker, accessibility and assistive technology coordinator at St. Mary's College, and is working on a doctorate degree in educational technology. It's rare to meet someone who is applying all of his educational experiences with such consistency and cohesion. It's like he's wasted nothing. All his experiences are tools used to help people with a disability achieve their goals academically. Austin is warm, thoughtful, engaging, full of energy. As you listen, think about how much Austin has already achieved, how much good he's brought into the world, and how much more he can still do. Austin is a reminder that barriers can be navigated. Our limits are not where we think they are. I'm honored to promote and support people like Austin who help nourish the possibilities in ourselves and each other. If you're enjoying the show, please share it with a friend, colleague, family member. Sharing with people really helps the show grow. It helps us spread the word and it helps us reach more people. Thank you so much. See you on the next show. Austin, it's great to see you again. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show.
Yes, thank you so much, Gustavo. I'm really excited to be here, and I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome. So let's start close to the beginning. You are, if we had grown up together, we would have been essentially neighbors, right? You grew up in Encino, California, and I was in Tarzana, so pretty close by.
Well, I actually want to note that I went to school in Encino, but I actually had quite the bus ride because I was more in the like the Santa Monica area and like Pacific Palisades. So it was really a jump over the canyon. I was actually sometimes up at 5:50 in the morning to get on the bus and had like an hour and a half bus ride to get that's over to Encino.
That's a long bus ride. All right. So we'll just take it as in LA terms, an hour and a half is like being a neighbor.
Yes.
So when we spoke last time, I think it's really interesting for people to understand, like when you were growing up early on, you were in public schools, correct? And your experience in public school was not the best. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what that was like and a little bit about your disability so the audience gets a feel for, you know, a little bit more about you?
Yes, of course. I have very mild cerebral palsy. And growing up, you know, what really was challenging for me was that I needed extra time for processing. So like extra time for tests and things of that nature. I also had very difficult time when it came to handwriting and drawing. My writing was very illegible. So it was hard for me taking notes in the classroom. And then in addition to that, when I was in the classroom, I also had visual processing. So it was hard for me to kind of remember sometimes people and places. So, and just kind of getting the visual content that, you know, teachers would put up on the board was sometimes difficult. And with those things, it kind of encountered issues with reading as well, because when I was trying to learn to read, a lot of the reading was taught with a lot of visual images of like, this is a picture of an apple, or trying to get you to kind of connect the word with the image. And I don't really connect the images as well. So it was better for me to, later I was able to kind of learn more phonetically how to read, and that really registered. But at the public school, it was much more using the visual and then the word and trying to foster a connection that way. And I would say, in addition, I also had a really hard time with speech too. I had a stutter, and it was difficult for me to, when I actually was born with 6 tube operations. I was born with a double ear infection. And then throughout my first 6 years, I got a tube operation each year on my ears to be able to hear, because my hearing initially sounded like it was underwater. And that really impacted how I picked up language. So I had a lot of, I would pronounce words wrong and things of that nature. And what, so my challenge, those are kind of some of the challenges that I was kind of encountering as I entered, public school and trying to work around those things. I kind of, when I was there, I encountered a lot of, the professors, the teachers couldn't always adapt basically to me and provide the accommodations that, that I needed to really engage in the classroom.
Understood. Did the hearing challenges that you have also affect your sense of balance, or was it mostly just, did it? Yes, it did. Okay.
In fact, it's funny, my mom would joke, because I was like the first kid to climb up the big slide in the park. And then I was I got my tube operation, and I was the kid scared to climb up the slide after that, because it really affected my balance and made me afraid of heights. Even to this day, I feel uncomfortable as I get my equilibrium kind of gets thrown off sometimes when I'm high up.
Interesting. And did you feel like, what were your friends like in public school? Did you have like a good connection with them, or was it more like, family and closer friends outside of school?
I definitely was connected, with my family, particularly my parents, my grandparents. But I also, I had friends in public school. I actually developed some good relationships because I played basketball, and there were other students playing basketball. Keep in mind, I was around, kindergarten to fourth grade. So I was younger. But that was like something that I like to do. I like to play sports, and my dad had taught me to dribble with my left hand. I think I would have been like left-handed if I didn't have cerebral palsy, which is kind of interesting. I'm pretty ambidextrous, depending on the situation. I can really use either hand for a lot of things. I think that's I prefer my left side, but my right side is stronger. So I ended up using more, writing with my right hand and things like that. But yeah, I had a connection there. The problem that I really encountered was more bullying in school, particularly when it came, a lot of that was set up sometimes by the teachers and how things were being done. One example that really that occurred to me that really stands out is I was in class in fourth grade trying to take notes. And I was really struggling to keep up taking notes from the board. And I could barely, read the writing of the notes I was taking. And the teacher's like, no one can leave until Austin finishes taking notes from the board. And I kept everyone late for recess for like 5 minutes. And that certainly turned the class against me. And I remember all like one of the kids, calling me, I think like stupid or something like that, and telling me, don't make us late again. And it was, those type of experiences that really made me want to leave public school, because I really didn't feel supported in that way. But I did have, some friends, particularly from the sports side.
And what changed? So, I think you said before, like your mom was a big advocate and taught you how to advocate for yourself. So she went on a journey to find a school that was be more flexible, more understanding, more accommodating and inclusive.
Yes,
correct. Yeah,
exactly. And she was also a big advocate at my IEP meeting. Sometime I was little and really advocating for me that I needed, different accommodations and different supports. And what ended up, happening with her was that she and my dad, particularly my mom, was looking at all different schools, and she found this school in the Valley called Westmark that at the time was a non-public school. So it was pretty diverse because other students, you know, could get funding to go there. So it wasn't just a pure private school, and it specialized in helping students with disabilities, particularly dyslexia and auditory processing. And I was just really blessed to be able to go there, and they gave me a computer, and it really changed my outlook. I think one thing I just want to mention, another story from my public school, is that my mom was advocated to actually get me out of resource, because resource was like the special education for students, and they were pulling me out of class to go there. And I just remember, like, you know, in class you get these little pretzels and everyone has them. And I go into this resource room and this woman has this giant Costco thing of pretzels. And it was like, you know, oh, he doesn't need the little ones, he needs the big one. She's like, if you answer the question, you'll get this big pretzel. And it was just like, it's not a motivation thing. It's something deeper going on with the processing. And so my mom actually, you know, showed that my grades were going down by going to this resource program because I was missing class. So I my grades went up when I stopped going.
It's let's talk a little bit about that. Like, what is, so going to those programs are supposed to be, right? Are supposed to be flexible and understanding. They're supposed to help you actually accelerate through school. I don't know if they're supposed to push you, but you would hope that they would, but that's not really what ends up happening at those programs, right? That's why, like, my mom growing up, she was told by my occupational therapist, my first one here, don't ever let your son go to a special school. Always push to go to a normal, quote unquote, normal school, right? She had experience. She knew what that was. What's missing there? Like, what's the gap? Is it, you know, because it doesn't make sense to me. It would seem like you would want to structure it in a very different way than it is.
I think what really ends up happening at those, you know, the public school environment is it's very hard for them to kind of figure out for each student what is the best strategies and what's the optimum time to go to the resource. Like at Westmark, I would stay after class, like after all my classes, for an hour with a tutor one-on-one, working on reading and then working on organization. They didn't really have that built-in flexibility to have someone there an hour before or hour after school to offer that. So they're taking the student out of class to do it. And then kind of in addition to that, I think a lot of the processes were, you know, maybe it was just me or me with one or two other students, and they kind of didn't really adapt to what my needs were. And it was just more of like, you know, this is the general way we're kind of working, and I'm just going to follow that pattern rather than really trying to see and personalize, you know, the support for the student.
Isn't that something that, I know you, you're an occupational therapist as well, and you went through that training. Isn't that something that, forget systemically for a second, but having occupational therapists in the school environment would help that out tremendously, right? Because your training is actually built towards understanding the person and helping that person problem solve what's best for them.
Yeah. Oh, the focus of OT is really on trying to understand the whole person in a holistic way and what their goals are, and then finding the supports, particularly, you know, whatever environmental or modifications need to be made to the tasks so that they can achieve their outlook and goals. One way I like to kind of look at it, you know, when you're talking about looking at from an OT framework, I think of the person, environment, and occupation model. It's called the PEO model for short. And what it kind of does is it looks at the person. So like I was a student, you know, having difficulties with writing. And the ultimate goal for me was to take notes. Now, there's a lot of different ways to kind of do that. You could give someone a pencil to take notes, but that was more difficult for me. You could type to take notes. you could have like a smart pen that would record and then also let you handwrite. You know, there's so many different outlooks of how to do it, but the end goal is to help that person, you know, for, in this case with note taking, but whatever their long-term goal is. And a lot of times I don't think they're looking at that way of how we can we modify the task, what supports can we provide to help the student, you know, achieve their long-term goal.
So you agree that an occupational therapist is an important, you know, would be an important person to have at a school so that they can adapt to those students and help them fulfill their potential.
Definitely. I agree with that. And, you know, I had OT growing up and it was really beneficial for me. Some of the things I worked on in the school, one of the things, you know, it's very simplistic, but I have a hard time sensing temperature, especially when I was younger. So if it was cold out and my mom gave me a jacket, I would wear the jacket the whole day and I wouldn't take it off. Even if it got like 90 degrees or whatever, I would still have it on. So she was really helping me be mindful and saying, why don't you, you know, take a moment and just at lunch, look and see how everyone's dressed. And then you can kind of make those decisions. And just little tips like that, you know, can be really helpful for people. And I remember her also working a lot with me on my handwriting and trying to give me different strategies. One of the things that I had a private OT as well, and they really worked with me on shoe tying because I really struggled to tie my own shoes. I actually, in public school, I once asked a kid to tie my shoes because I couldn't tie them, and he bullied me and tied them together. And then I had to tell the teacher, you know, can you help me untie my shoes? But, you know, that was a real challenge for me, and still is sometimes when it comes to like ties and things of that nature. But, you know, it's really great what OTs can help with and the wide variety of areas that they're able to provide support in.
Yep. Absolutely. So during your time at Westmark, you know, what was that like to be in such an inclusive environment? At that time, it was a smaller school, right? So you had smaller size classrooms. You know, what were the teachers like? What were those experiences like?
It was just such a positive experience because, first off, there was like no bullying because all the students had been bullied. So there really wasn't any real, like there were cliques, but there weren't any conflict really between the cliques. And then in addition to that, you know, I had this Alpha Smart. It's like a little keyboard basically with a small black and white screen. And I could type all my notes on it, which was fantastic. And I was went from being, you know, the slowest person taking notes to the fastest person taking notes. And it was just such a great experience there. And then, you know, with it being a smaller class, I could really discuss with the other students and with the teacher and kind of really dive into the different topics, which was really helpful. And I would say too that the after school tutoring I had was instrumental in teaching me how to read, and then also working with me with organizational skills, because I really, even to this day, I have a hard time sometimes, you know, with organizing things and, you know, taking the time to kind of make sure, you know, these are the assignments, these are when, you know, when they're due. Was really helpful. I use those skills today to always write everything down in my calendar apps and planners and things like that.
That's awesome. And during that time at Westmark, you got into film, correct?
Yes, I made tons of films all throughout my time at Westmark. What was really great about Westmark was that they actually had they called it the Westmark News Network, and it was a live news show that they would do for all the students, and it went through all the TVs. And I think in like fifth or sixth grade, right when I first got there, I was put in and I helped work like the switchboard, and some of my friends were working on it. We all did different videos together, and it was really nice to be able to get the training, because Final Cut Pro, you know, that's a professional application, and we were able to get access to that and use the technology to make our like little music videos and interviews. So it was really great to have that experience. And that's what really made me decide to major in film production later when I graduated, because I knew that that was a skill that I had gotten to develop and really gotten to use much more than most students.
That's so awesome. It's such a good example of, right, how empowering a school can be if, when they do things correctly, like so much potential. I'm just on this, you know, it's in my mind all the time, like human potential. The better our society is, the more we are fulfilling human potential, right? That to me is why we're here. We have, and it's just so beautiful to see a school structured that way, and to see how it helped you grow and empower you to go into college as a, you know, wanting to major in film. So then what was college like for you?
College was really a great experience. You know, one of the things that happened when I was looking at colleges was Westmark recommended Loyola Marymount. And it was really beneficial for me to be able to go there because of the fact that they had a great student disability office to offer supports. And then they also, you know, had this healthy living dorm that I was on. And there were a lot of like-minded students, you know, like me, as I never really was into like partying or anything like that. So I was kind of able to find friends to kind of go and go on hikes and just kind of drive around and explore and stuff. And I found that really, really beneficial. I think the big transition going to college as a student with a disability is just getting used to talking about your disability with people. Because I think there's a tendency to want to hide that. And when I was there, you know, it was a big change going from Westmark, where every professor, you know, they know about your disability, and they kind of have all the information. Some of the professors, honestly, something that's kind of, I don't know if I mentioned to you, but it's kind of funny, is that I really wasn't told that I had cerebral palsy. The label of cerebral palsy is something I really learned about my senior year at Westmark. Before that, I would tell every student I had, every professor, every teacher, I had visual processing and I had dysgraphia. My parents didn't want me to know about cerebral palsy because they didn't want me to use that as an excuse not to do things. So I was like still doing sports and all those types of experiences. They didn't want me to use it to hold me back in that way. And there were a lot of other students there who had dysgraphia. So it kind of I didn't feel you know different in that sense. But when you go to the college, you have to be comfortable talking about your disability. So I would, each professor before class or after class or in office hours, I would go and say, you know, I have mild cerebral palsy. I have you know these are my accommodations. I really enjoy film. Is there any way you're doing like an art project? Please let me use film in some capacity. Is that's what I want to do? And you know, a lot of them were very flexible and open to that. So that was really beneficial.
That's awesome. How do you feel like if your parents had told you sooner, it might have limited you in some way, or because it doesn't sound like that was part of your story that you were telling yourself in your internal narrative, anyways, right? Like,
yes.
How do you think you would have reacted?
I think I would have reacted about the same. I think, you know, I don't think it was something that was really limiting to me, but I think that, you know, my parents just didn't want to. I had so many different things going on, and you know, like with speech therapy and occupational therapy and on being bullied, they kind of wanted to try and, you know, just promote an environment where I was just like the other students pretty much. And that was their way of kind of doing it. And then, you know, over time, I feel like it was nice to kind of know what cerebral palsy was, and then, you know, making that connection, because then it was like, oh, I have this, and I could kind of, I, you know, this, you know, this is my, you know, my label, but it also kind of covers, you know, some of the things I experienced, because there were differences where I remember a student, you know, kind of saying at Westmark, oh, you know, my dysgraphia has improved a little bit or whatnot. And, you know, cerebral palsy doesn't change that way. So then once I knew I had that, I was like, okay, this makes sense why my dysgraphia is not changing, or why, you know, this isn't, what my array of different, differences are, why they're like that. So it really helped kind of clear things up for me.
Interesting. And how did you learn how to talk and get comfortable with your disability in college? What were some of those? What was that moment when you realized, was it with the professors where you realized you had to say something because they didn't know?
Honestly, a lot of that came to my parents and especially my mom. Like I remember we would, I would do a lot of, developing scripts of like what I was going to say, when I went into that first, semester and talking with the different professors. I remember seeing my mom, at the different meetings talk about, on my behalf sometimes about things and she always encouraged me to kind of advocate and, share my thoughts. And so I really felt like that really helped me because my parents were really having me kind of think about, well, what are you going to say when you're in class and, you need to talk to the professor about your different accommodations and your disability. Are you going to be comfortable? Why don't we write something down that you can kind of use? Let's focus on your strengths and enjoying film and stuff. So having parents like that who are really supportive really helped me feel comfortable in that environment and make the transition successfully.
Your mom sounds like a very powerful woman. It's really cool. That's a nice thing to have in your corner, right? Growing up. What were some of the students like at Loyola? How did that experience go?
It was really positive for me. I found my group of friends, and a lot of that was all the people who lived on the same floor as me, which was like this healthy living floor. And so they all kind of enjoyed, hiking and just different activities that were more outdoorsy and things, and not not so much the typical fraternity life and that type of stuff. So that was really how I kind of made my friends there. And then also, making friends through the film school as well. Although I'll say, for one of the things I noticed as a challenge for me that I didn't think about when I first chose film as a major was just that when you're in, with film, a lot of things happen late at night. And I like to go to bed early and I need extra sleep. And there were a lot of times where I'd be asked, can you help on my set? We're filming all through the evening, basically. And I just couldn't do it. I volunteered on a couple different things, but then I'd always have to miss class like afterward to catch up on my sleep. And I just was very impressed how some students, were able to kind of pull these all-nighters to do the film. And I just really wasn't... that was a limiting factor for me for making friends in that realm, is I just couldn't do that as much.
Interesting. Whenever I pulled an all-nighter, I mean, it didn't matter. I was a mess the next day. I didn't function well. And most of my friends, some people were the exception, didn't function very well either. So it just, I don't know. I just call that procrastination when you have to film through the night.
I think what happened though there is just it's hard scheduling because you don't want people to miss class too. So that ends up the evenings end up being the time where everyone's filming. And then some students, who are film majors, I understand this, they were less focused on their overall, whatever the main courses were, like, taking your English or whatnot on those grades. They were okay letting it slip a little bit so they could be on more of these projects. And I was more focused on trying to get the best grades I could and just trying to, just trying to find my own balance basically for staying healthy and everything. So I couldn't always jump on those late night film sessions.
That's a good point. And then was it your last year or your third year where you actually studied abroad for a year and you went to Germany, right?
Yes, I studied abroad in my third year. It was a really great experience. I went to Bonn, Germany. It was part of Loyola Marymount's connection. Like they facilitated everything, which was really nice. And what that allowed me to basically do is I could work with the study abroad office and the disability office to arrange different accommodations. And one of the main accommodations I had when I went over there was a smartphone with GPS. It was like the first Samsung Galaxy smartphone. And it was just a really cool experience because having that phone allowed me to travel around and get to my home. Because you have to understand, I have face blindness and kind of really difficulty remembering places and faces. So I use the GPS to get to work still. I've been working at St. Mary's now for like almost 4 years. So it's like I am very reliant on the GPS to get to places. And, you know, having that being in another country without that GPS, I really wouldn't have been able to do it. But I felt so blessed to have it. And then to be able to go on these different adventures, I went and I interviewed a Holocaust survivor in Berlin. I also did my whole documentary on anti-Semitism in Germany today and kind of interviewing different people throughout Germany. So it was really just an amazing experience to have.
That's awesome. And you said that the people that you interacted with there were pretty nice, pretty accommodating, pretty inclusive, right?
Yes, they were. It was very inclusive. And, you know, I feel like it was just, you know, everyone was very welcoming at the center and very accommodating for me, which was really great. And I think it also helped me see that I really liked editing on that trip, because I found going through the footage and everything, I really liked that process. I even was helping with some of the other students I was on, kind of looking at different, editing things. And that kind of that trip kind of shaped me a little bit to be thinking about being an editor at that point.
What was the main takeaway from that documentary? I know it's slightly off course, but I think it's such an interesting thing to, you know, what is anti-Semitism? What was at that time? What was the nature of anti-Semitism in Germany?
I think what it really came down to was I interviewed a lot of Jewish people that as much as I could from the different synagogues and going there. And what I really noted was that a lot of people there who were Jewish just didn't feel so comfortable talking about being Jewish in public. And I think that's something that unfortunately is, I could understand that even today becoming more of a common thing of people wanting to keep sometimes, you know, their faith or their ethnic traditions and stuff more private. And at the time, it really surprised me that people were so quiet about those things. But I think in Germany, there's just not a lot of people who are Jewish. The percentage is rather small. And so there was just kind of that tendency to kind of keep things more, quiet about that. Like an example that came to mind was that, like, you know, I was interviewing this this student. And he was saying that, you know, when he went to the mall to get a tie, he wouldn't tell anybody that he was Jewish. He would just, you know, say, oh, you know, I was like, if it's Yom Kippur, I'd be like, oh, it's Yom Kippur. I want a nice tie, you know, for the high holiday. He's like, I would never say that. What if they're anti-Semitic? I would just say, you know, I just want a nice tie for this for an event that I'm going to. And it was just interesting, the differences of that.
So it's not necessarily that anti-Semitism was high in Germany. It's more like you're such a minority and you have that history of that Second World War where you feel like it's safer or easier to just not mention it.
Yes, I think that's exactly what it is. And kind of you could see that too, you know, when you look at how things are presented sometimes there with the different monuments and things of the mind. I think there's a big Jewish monument in Berlin where it's kind of a lot of sculpted like it looks like a cave sort of, and you're kind of walking through and the blocks are very high up and you can see, it's not like an enclosed cave, so you can see up but you can't see to the left or right of the blocks, but it doesn't say anything that this is a Jewish monument for you know, people who died in the Holocaust or that type of thing. It's not that direct. It's all very subtle. And I think that subtlety was something that I really picked up on when I was there.
That's interesting. And so when you came back, what was your next, what was your next journey? Why did you decide not to go into film?
Well, I want to add, when I came back from my senior year, I made my thesis film about students with disabilities and the difference between public school and private school. And I used all students from Westmark to act out the film. And it was a really positive experience for me, and to get to go back to Westmark was just amazing. And they were really helpful with it. And, you know, those type of things kind of led me to think that, oh, I want to do film. And then I went to a post-production company to work as an assistant. And what I kind of found was that the meaning that I was taking from my films, you know, I was choosing things that were really meaningful to me. But when you're editing, you know, the average, you know, blockbuster movie, it's not always so meaningful. And you're kind of, sometimes they were really looking at how can we trick people into seeing these bad movies. And I didn't want to be that guy who's like, you know, oh, I tricked a lot of people into seeing this, you know. So that was one issue. And the other thing that kind of came into play for me was with my disability, I didn't really realize at the time that it's so important as an editor to really pick up on the faces of the different people and, you know, picking up on, you know, the different scenes and being able to recall them really quickly. And so I kind of struggled through a 2-hour movie to remember, and they're like, you know, when's this scene or where's this character like in this wardrobe? And I wouldn't really remember those things. And so, you know, those two things in accommodation, you know, really kind of led me to be rethinking, you know, what I was doing, and kind of led me to go to occupational therapy, as I really felt like I could give back and help people. And that's what I wanted to do.
And I mean, kudos to you for understanding that it's not good to trick people into seeing crappy movies, which, you know, Hollywood doesn't do that anymore. You know, that doesn't happen. they've gotten over that. But it, like, did you think, you know, do you think today, even with all you're doing, like maybe at some point you'll go back and do a series of documentaries, like films, that things that matter to you, because you still have the skills, you still have the talent, and you have that vision. Is that something that you still hold as a possibility?
Yes, I definitely do. And that's kind of why, you know, I'm getting my doctorate right now in educational technology. And over the summer, I chose kind of an independent study type course where I was really working on coming up with different videos about accessibility, particularly like digital accessibility, which is really becoming more of a passion of mine. And I think that, you know, having the skills to be able to edit and create, I still want to use that. And that's why I've been, you know, trying to make those videos on YouTube, and be, hopefully, you know, we'll find more ways to kind of integrate those skills. I would say too, in my current experience at St. Mary's College, one of the things I've really been able to do is use my film background to make tutorial videos. And I made a ton of tutorial videos on how to use all the different assistive technology and all of that. So I still get to really incorporate the film skills that I learned throughout Loyola Marymount and Westmark to today, which is really great.
That's awesome. So tell us about digital accessibility. What's going on in that space that is important that you're working on?
It's sort of like a wild west. I feel like, you know, it's something where, you know, unfortunately, the way the ADA, you know, when the Americans with Disabilities Act was written, the internet was just not a thing at that time. It wasn't what it is today. And so what we're kind of seeing right now is this massive growth of the internet and the issue of how can we regulate these different websites and applications to ensure that they're all accessible for people. And a lot of times, one of the big studies is like the WebAIM Million study. They look at the top 1 million websites and they analyze like each homepage for accessibility errors. And they're still finding like 45 errors per webpage on average of different accessibility barriers that are present, which just shows that the awareness isn't there. And then also, the regulation really isn't there for requiring everyone to meet the web content accessibility guidelines, like the WCAG AA standards that are becoming, and a lot of lawsuits right now, that's what's kind of cited as the accessibility standard. But it's just a lot of people, I think, when they're making sites and making applications and things, they're not always considering the accessibility side.
How do you feel about some of the companies out there, web companies out there that have created those accessibility widgets that claim that they fix the websites?
Make
them accessible.
I had done a YouTube video where I had in the thumbnail like an image of somebody selling snake oil, because I think that's what those things are. You know, making something accessible really starts and is easiest to do at the beginning in the design stage. That's what you want. If you think about the ADA and how it impacts how buildings are designed, when we're designing a building, it's not like, oh, you know, we should put an elevator in after the building's made. It's like, okay, we're going to start with that because we know that that's part of the ADA is to ensuring accessibility. And I think with a lot of these, you know, websites, it's bolt on after the fact. It's like, oh, we made the website. Now I'll just, you know, purchase this widget or whatever, and it'll fix everything. And it's more complicated than that. And you also really want to provide an experience for people. So there's a real market for people with disabilities who are looking to purchase items, looking to use social media and websites and things. So it's really important that you think that you're excluding, you know, a significant portion of your audience if you're not thinking about digital accessibility.
Yep. So do you think that the concept of the widget then is flawed, or do you think that the execution is flawed?
I think that you can't just say, like, some of these companies, I think what ends up happening is that they're kind of presenting it as a one size fits all solution. You purchase my product, your site's now AA accessible, no one's going to sue you. And it doesn't really work like that. Like, if you think about even the most accessible website, well, what happens? Every time you're going to update that website, right? You're going to add new content, new things to it. Well, then if you checked it to be accessible, you know, 2 years ago and you add a bunch of new content, it might not be accessible. So what really accessibility starts to become an interactive dialogue. And what I would really encourage anyone who has a website and they're concerned about accessibility, one of the things to be thinking about is not just how can you make the website accessible, which is certainly important aspect, but also how can I create a accessibility page on the website that stipulates, you know, who can someone contact if they're having encounter a barrier on the website? What is the recommended web browser to use? What's the recommended screen reading software to use? Because whatever you're testing with, that's probably going to be the most accessible experience for the person. So I think those are some things that are really important to keep in mind as well.
Yeah, I just was talking to Jonathan White. He's over at the Idea Center at University of Buffalo, and he's one of the universal design experts of the country. And the big theme there, right, the big takeaway for me there is planning at the beginning is so important, but also educating designers, whether you're a web designer, whether you're a car designer, whether you're an architect or an interior designer, you have a bigger responsibility than you realize when you're making something and putting it out into the world. You know, it's a real problem, right? To just think of something as, oh, I want to make this beautiful, or, oh, I want to make this, whatever it is, the best performing thing that it can be. But, you know, you have an obligation, you have a responsibility as a designer to say, who is this for? And how can I include as many people in this experience as possible, rather than just trying to, you know, have this little subset of people or this quote unquote, you know, average that doesn't really exist in real life?
Yes, exactly. It makes me think of Kat Holmes's book. I think it's Inclusive Design, something like that is the title. And what, you know, she talks about is, you know, you want to be designing not just for yourself, you want to be thinking about how are other people going to interact with the product or service. You know, what are the ways that you can foster the greatest amount of variation for interaction possible? And a lot of times, people aren't thinking in that way. They're just thinking, oh, I use it this way. Everyone's going to use it this way. And, you know, one of the examples she uses is thinking about the playground. If you go to a playground, like how can the swings be used differently? How accessible is the different equipment that's there? And, you know, looking at, like, I think there's a very inclusive water park in Texas that is specially designed for people with disabilities and to let them go on the merry-go-round. But most merry-go-rounds, if you think about how it is, it's very, you know, not inclusive. Like I don't think they even have ramps on a lot of them, and they don't, you know, all the horses are grouped very close together, but they don't think about, oh, if you spread it out, you could have a lot more people and it could be wheelchair accessible and it could be, you know, open to a lot of different people. If you could adjust the sound, so people on the autism spectrum, if they get, you know, it can adjust the volume there, so it's not too loud, things like that, that they're not thinking about. And it's the same thing with digital accessibility. You know, there's so much variation there of how people are going to use your product, how they're, you know, going to navigate, and just keeping that, you know, really using screen reading software, I think, is really important. Having a good understanding of how that software works.
So that's great points. And I don't know. I look at your life story that you've shared so far, right? And I see all these things that happened, partially for self-advocacy, partially because you found the right places. But look at everything you've accomplished. Look at everything you still have to accomplish. It would be tragic if those things hadn't happened, right? Like you are exceptionally bright. You are, you know, you, I can see, like, you have a tremendous amount of empathy. Like, you know, you're a good human being. The world is better because of where, you know, what you've been able to accomplish. It's just, the more I think people can understand that, and rather than stopping at, oh, the disability, or stopping at what they perceive as a weakness, like, there's so much that we can still do. There's so much that we can still contribute and give back, right? It's incredible.
Yes. Thank you, Gustavo. And I think that so many people, you know, people don't realize how having a disability can really shape how you see the world and open you up to a new perspective and a new way of seeing things. And I think that's really important for people to understand. You know, there are so many different inventions and things and technologies developed all based around, you know, people with disabilities and trying to access different things. I think of, you know, Eric Weinmayer. He is the first blind man to climb Mount Everest. And he also did the whole, I want to say the Colorado Rapids or Rocky, it's like whitewater rafting trail. He did the whole thing. And he had all these really amazing technologies that he was using. He had something in his mouth that could sense where the rocks were, and it would basically touch his tongue on the right or left side, depending where the rock was, so he knew to go the other way. And it was just really amazing how technology can really enable access for so many people, and using that, and also shaping how you see the world and how you interact. I'm reminded, you know, I am on the board of Ability Now Bay Area. They're an organization that supports people with cerebral palsy, and they have a day center that they run, and they have a business center there. And there's a lot of artists at Ability Now Bay Area that do amazing artwork and have amazing perspectives just on how they see the world, how they craft their photography and digital art. I just think that it's just such an, you know, it's really important that people can see beyond and just see how having a disability can really be and really open you up to just so many different perspectives and things.
Yep. Like you said, ingenuity, creativity, and that idea of variation, right? When we typically think of evolution, what we're told that, you know, natural selection calls out the weak and, you know, only the strong survive. And what we miss, I think anyways, and I'm not a biologist, but I'm just going to go out there and say this, is that diversity is actually the real key. The more biodiversity we have, the more perspectives we have, the more variation we have, the greater our ability is going to be to survive as a species. And
yes, definitely.
And yeah, we miss that point. We get so narrowly focused on what we think it means rather than what I think the theory is actually saying.
I think too, like another example that comes to mind is like the curb cut, because initially that was for wheelchair access to help get, get up on the sidewalks. But then you think about a mother pushing her baby, she benefits from the curb cut. Somebody on a skateboard benefits from the curb cut. So you start to see how it just creates broader access. And I think right now we're about to see a big digital change because a lot of the technologies for people with vision loss focused on scanning documents and doing optical character recognition. That's what I do a lot with textbooks and things. And what's occurring now with like Apple's Live Text for their new operating system on their iPhones and Mac, they're going to basically scan any photo you have for text, and it will be able to let you quickly highlight, the address or whatnot. And all that's coming from helping, people read and the text-to-speech solutions that were used for people with reading disabilities. So it just shows how, that diversity can lead to greater innovation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So what's next, Austin, for you? What are, when you get your doctorate, what are you planning on working on? What's the next step?
I just really want to, I want to definitely explore, digital accessibility. I'm very interested in trying to create inclusive content. I really like, working with professors on how to design courses that are as inclusive as possible and integrate universal design principles. And I'm also really interested, in different research, relating to accessibility. And I think, one of I recently worked with Dr. Hesu from Boise State University on a paper about the Marrakesh Treaty and the importance of accessible books. And I'd like to explore more things like that in the future too.
Interesting. So can you tell us really briefly about what the issue is with accessible books? Like why aren't worldwide?
Yes. Yeah. So one of the issues going on right now with accessible books is that they called it a global book famine. And basically, people with disabilities were unable to get accessible books, all throughout, different countries. And the reason is because the publishers weren't providing them to make them accessible, and the copyright laws did not allow reproduction. So most copyright laws did not provide an exemption for people with disabilities, or they were really specific and said, only people who are blind, the only format's Braille, and that really limited the ability to help people. In the US, we have the Chafee Amendment, which provides us greater exception for anyone with a print disability. And a print disability is a very broad term that can include people with dyslexia. It's a wider range than just people, who are blind or have vision loss. So what ended up happening with the Marrakesh Treaty is it loosened the countries that have joined it. I think it's like near 100 countries or more have signed on to it. And what they basically have done is with those countries that adopt the Marrakesh Treaty, they're allowing the education institutions, the libraries, nonprofits to go in and provide accessible books and remediate them to make them accessible, which I think is really beneficial and important. But I also think that it's important for the publishers to be thinking about, can we create a marketplace for accessible books that are just naturally accessible? And, kind of having the iTunes of accessible books where anyone could go and just purchase one would be the next step that I hope happens in the future.
Yeah, we talked briefly about this before, but it's just amazing to me that, publishing industry, right? You hear is book sales are down, people aren't reading anymore, we're struggling as an industry. And here's a market, like a real market where you could be maximizing your own profits and your own dollars by just releasing these books in other forms, and they don't do it. It's mind-boggling.
Yes, it totally is. And it also, it would just be great if they worked together on a platform that people could purchase accessible books from. I think there are a lot of nonprofits like Bookshare that are trying to provide accessible books, and Access Text is another one. But, you know, there is no centralized marketplace. And it's rather unfortunate that it's like that. And it also creates, you know, it's just odd. Like my job sometimes with the accessible books, I told you before, you know, I'll end up, you know, making a license agreement for one specific student to get so I can get a PDF of the book and make it accessible. And it's like, couldn't you just make that book accessible? You could have reached a lot more than this one student if you did. So,
yeah. Hopefully that changes. And I'm glad that you're doing, all this work. I'm glad that you're so committed to helping other people with disabilities get into higher education and have good experiences and grow themselves as people. It's just, it's really great to meet people like you and understand the work you're doing.
Well, it's amazing. I think what you're doing too with your show and just helping, you know, spread awareness about you know people with disabilities and providing a platform to give people a voice is really important. Because I just think that a lot of the issues that we encounter in the disability community relate to just people not being aware a lot of times. You know, people, I have professors all the time, they'll send out like PDFs and stuff to things. Or like a good example is, you know, there was a lot of email chains that would just be an image. So the people would just send, you know, here's an image of, you know, an event that's going to be next Friday. We're going to have a picnic or whatever. And I would be writing back, you know, no one who's using a screen reading software is going to know what this is. They're just going to hear image, you know, 1, 2, 4 JPEG. They're not going to know anything about your event. You should put in text what it is. And then it also benefits other people because Google can scan for the date and the time and say, oh, do you want to make a calendar invite and add this to your calendar? So, you know, there's a lot of benefits to thinking more about people with disabilities. And once people are aware of it, then everything changes. And everyone suddenly, you know, is typing text inside, you know, their emails and not just including the image and things like that.
Yep, that's so true. That's the hope, at least, right? And I think you're right. I think that the more awareness we can bring and the more openness to have these conversations and share our experiences, it's going to continue to have positive impacts.
Yes, definitely. And I also think that, you know, as, with the news and with the accessibility lawsuit, some of the things that have happened have helped shape it as well, that we may see more policy in the future. Because I really think that's another avenue as well, is if you have an expansion of the ADA or some type of addendum that really goes into digital accessibility, we would see more WCAG, you know, AA compliant websites and greater accessibility for people.
Yeah, yes, I agree. And I think that if it could be broadened or rewritten, you know, that it should also apply to new single family homes, right? Which there's no regulation for. And we see a real lack of accessible homes and universally designed homes in the country.
Yes, I remember you mentioning that last time. That is a really important issue too. I hope that could be included as well.
So Austin, what have we missed in this conversation that you feel is important to talk about?
I feel like we covered a lot of ground, you know, with the different subjects. I'm trying to think.
But maybe we didn't. Is there anything else that you are working on that you'd like to, you know, put out there to help amplify, or something that you know, a new project, anything? Or go ahead.
I'm just thinking. I think, you know, I think overall, you know, it's just for me, I'm just really focused right now on you know, getting my doctorate in educational technology and really trying to advocate for you know, different accessibility issues. I think we covered some of the major, you know, topics right now that, you know, that are currently going on. I think, you know, I would, my main message for students, you know, with disabilities is just to be, you know, comfortable talking about the idea of, you know, with professors about your disability, and really knowing that the disability office is there to have your back. That would really be, my main message to any student with a disability looking at that transition, because I think that a lot of times people want to try and hide those things, and it can be much more of a weight. You know, an example that comes to mind from my transition to college was that I didn't want people to know that I had face blindness. And so I remember my first week, you know, I'm meeting all these new people. I only knew about 33 students in my graduating class. And suddenly I'm meeting, you know, like 100 students or more, you know, all at once. And there was this one girl that was in the dorm, and she had, curly hair when I met her. And then she went to, we went to like the soccer game, and suddenly she had straightened her hair. And I thought she was a new person. I went up to everybody and introduced myself to her. And then, you know, that kind of, you know, that, and then I was like, oh, I better tell everybody. It's a lot easier just to say, look, I have mild cerebral palsy. I have face blindness. I'm sorry. I get confused sometimes with faces. And once I said that, it was just total relief, because then everybody knew, and I just was able to feel much more comfortable being involved, you know, entering the environment and people knowing that. So I think it's really important to share sometimes with that. And that can be a challenge.
Well, do you have a few more minutes? Because I just have a story that came to mind that I wanted to run by you and see what you think.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So when I was in school, there were very few accommodations that I had. Like there were definitely some, like if the class was too far, you know, if I ran a couple minutes late, it wasn't a big deal, and et cetera. But when I was in law school, I have one arm. And most, like this was 2002 to 2005. So by that point in time, most people had computers, the exams were typed, most people didn't handwrite. And I remember, somebody at student services saying like, look, do you want to take extra time? Like law school, the exams were super time sensitive, right? You had whatever it was, 2 hours, and oftentimes you were graded on not just what you said, but how much you could literally type out, right? The more arguments you made, the more points. And I could type, you know, 30 to 35 words a minute, but there were definitely, most of the class was typing faster than that. So they said, do you want extra time? And that was the first time I had been, you know, offered that. And I was thinking, well, you know, I've never needed it before, so I'm not going to take that, and I'm just going to do it on the regular time that the rest of the students have. In retrospect, I think I made a mistake. I think that it would have been better for me to say, like, you know, yes, I want extra time, but I think I only need half an hour extra, as opposed to like, I think they were going to offer me like 2 hours extra, because then it felt to me like my thinking at the time was I'm getting an unfair advantage if I get all of this extra time. So, you know, from how do you evaluate that? Like my decision-making and what maybe I should have done in retrospect. What do you think of that?
Well, I agree with what you're saying about, you know, cause you, even if you took the 2 hours and you only used an extra 30 minutes or whatever, you know, it doesn't really matter. Getting extra time is, you know, can be helpful, you know, for typing in that situation. And I think we encounter a lot of times students who sometimes don't feel comfortable using all their accommodations. We'll be like, you know, we can offer you, you know, time and a half or double time. And they would say, no, I don't want to do that. And, you know, I think that is important to understand that, you know, if it's something that could benefit you and make it easier, you might as well, you know, use that accommodation to help with that. I think about it, you know, there's a couple different analogies that kind of come to mind. You know, if you're going to hop in a car from like San Francisco and drive down to Los Angeles or something, if your friend is taking up all the leg room, yeah, you could sit in the back seat and have no leg room. But it would be a lot more comfortable if you just say, hey, could you just scoot your chair a little bit forward and I can have some room? And similarly, like with food allergies, everyone's comfortable saying, oh, I can't eat, you know, peanut butter, I can't eat this or that. So, you know, I think being comfortable speaking up for yourself sometimes becomes really important and acknowledging that, you know, you deserve, you know, having that accommodation and that adaptation and not feeling guilty about that.
Yeah, it doesn't make you less than, and it doesn't necessarily give you an unfair advantage either. It's just, you know, your individual situation.
Exactly. I think that's really important way to see it. I mean, I could have seen, you know, with my situation typing everything, you know, I could have been like, oh, I'm typing faster than everyone else for notes. But, you know, I just saw it that really helped me. And you know, I knew the other students, you know, were able to they liked handwriting and everything. So it wasn't an issue for them. But for me, it really was. And that's why I felt really comfortable using that accommodation. But yeah, I think that's definitely important.
Awesome. Thank you for that. Where can people find you? Where can people connect and learn more about you?
I have a website, austinstam.com, and I also do a YouTube channel called Access Austin, and I try and post videos each week about different accessibility-related topics and things.
Fantastic. Austin, I'm so happy we connected. I'm so happy you were on the show, and I look forward to staying in touch and, you know, getting some future collaborations going.
Yes, that sounds great, Gustavo. Thank you so much for having me. I feel so grateful to have this opportunity.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure. Have a great day.
You too.